to December 31st. The latest hike is due to the expiration of measures introduced in May to mitigate the nefarious effects on Italy's economy of an exceptionally high increase in the cost of energy that followed the start of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. The price of unleaded petrol stands now at about 1.8 euros per litre, while that of diesel has reached almost 2 euros.
The increase in fuel costs at the turn of the new year is mainly due to the reinstatement of the full rates of excise duty and VAT on petrol, diesel and LPG that the former government led by Mario Draghi introduced last year. The spike is also due to the higher cost of mixing biofuels with petrol and diesel as required by the law.
Experts fear fuel prices might even increase further after February the 5th, when a European Union ban on Russian oil product imports kicks in as part of sanctions against Moscow over the war in Ukraine. This follows a ban on Russian crude that took effect in December.
With a population of 59 million and about 40 million circulating vehicles, it is easy to understand how vital is the role of road transport in Italy. It accounts for three quarters of all land transportation of goods. It goes without saying that the country's rising fuel costs for both petrol and diesel will have dreadful consequences for medium and small businesses and for everyday people.
While wages remain the same, fuel in general, energy costs keep rising. I'm very worried. Too much uncertainty.
What worries me the most is the fact that wages remain unchanged while the cost of living is skyrocketing. I have four kids and we are struggling to make ends meet.
Higher fuel prices further swell living costs for people in Italy as electricity and gas bills have increased by about 300% since September. Italy was expecting to raise almost 10 billion euros from measures targeting the super profits made by energy companies that benefited from the surge in oil and gas prices. So far, only one quarter of that amount has been paid to the tax office. Max Civili, Rome.
The Center for Political and International Studies of the Iranian Foreign Ministry has organized a specialized roundtable focusing on the fight against terrorism and extremism in the West Asia region. Guests and attendees from different Iranian institutions and bodies took part in the forum, which concentrated on efforts made by the Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Among the most significant topics discussed during the meeting were fighting terrorism in the West Asia region from the point of view of international law, the role of General Soleimani in fighting terrorism in the West Asia region, and the role of the United Nations in fight on terror in the West Asia region. On the sidelines of the meeting, Iran's former ambassador to Iraq, Iraj Masjidi, highlighted the late commander's role in neutralizing terrorist groups in neighboring countries.
When Lieutenant General Soleimani was assassinated, I was working as the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Iraq. He would frequently travel to Iraq in order to confront the ISIS terrorist group and help the Iraqi armed forces and Hashd al-Sha'bi with planning and logistic support. In other words, he played a prominent role in Iraq in the fight against terrorists.
Masjidi also said that efforts to bring a prosecution against those involved in the assassination of General Soleimani continues. In this regard, the head of a special Iranian committee tasked with pursuing the case of General Soleimani's assassination in domestic and international courts said an indict on the assassination will be announced soon. He was referring to a report by a UN expert on extrajudicial killings concluding that the targeting of General Soleimani and those accompanying him constitute an arbitrary killing for which the U.S. is responsible.
Iran has had a significant role in the fight against terrorism in the West Asia region, particularly in Iraq and Syria. And Iran's top anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, played a pivotal role in combating terrorism and defeating Daesh. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Brits are still reeling from the impact of 2022. It's hard to recall a political year that's seen the country lurch from one crisis to the next. All bookended, it seems, by the saga of which particular Conservative Prime Minister was in charge. Boris Johnson had managed to cling on to power despite mounting evidence presented that his position had become untenable. His missteps during lockdown, dubbed Partygate, a faltering economy exacerbated by the outbreak of conflict in Ukraine, made his departure an inevitability. The race to replace him was brutal, exposing the deep divisions within the Conservatives. Party members chose Liz Truss over Sunak before, but that was only the beginning of the saga. Analyst Chris Bambury was following events closely and reflects on that period of chaos.
We had this strange interim where Liz Truss beat Sunak, clearly showing that a majority of the Conservative Party membership were not going to vote for Sunak for reasons which I think are fairly obvious, which are never really talked about. But Truss was a disaster. And then we ended up with Sunak being shoehorned into the prime ministership with no actual election.
I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
Ah, the blink and you'll miss it Truss era. 7 weeks of chaos which saw the pound take a hit and the markets recoil at the sheer ineptitude on political display. There was a sense that the UK's political landscape had now become a running joke.
The chaos of the Liz Truss premiership, you know, was just awesome. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that in British politics. British politics is supposed to be about stability. It prides itself in selling itself, Britain, as a brand to the rest of the world that has been politically stable. This was like Italian politics, you know, and the prime minister just coming and going. This did not give a vision of Britain as a stable political entity.
Not content with topsy-turvy politics, the UK's longest-serving monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, passed away aged 96, leaving the UK contemplating its colonial legacy. With King Charles III with Camilla, Queen Consort, by his side, it was a new era, but one filled with old uncertainties.
I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set in upholding constitutional government and to seek the peace, harmony, and prosperity of the peoples of these islands.
Despite the passing of the baton, the impact of Brexit, the stalemate in the north of Ireland, with the cost of living crisis biting, Prime Minister's in-tray was bulging. 2022 is also the year Britain saw a re-emergence of strike action across a multitude of sectors.
We have been reasonable, but it is impossible to find a negotiated settlement when the dead hand of the government is presiding over and blocking a resolution in these talks.
We are seeing the recovery of industrial unrest, workers taking trade union action, and finding that when they go on strike, they are popular, that people sympathise with them, sections of the working class and indeed the middle class. And I think that spells trouble ahead. These strikes, we haven't seen anything like this in Britain really since the days of Margaret Thatcher. This is new, and I think people are learning new habits, new skills of taking industrial disputes, and I think potentially this is a bit of a game changer down the road.
Rishi Sunak and the rest of his Conservative government will be desperately hoping that there is not a repeat of the past tumultuous year, a 12-month period that's seen record number of Brits slide into poverty. But analysts are warning that desperate changes need to happen because so far it seems the Tories are heavy on excuses and light on solutions. On the cusp of a new year, there are many challenges awaiting the average British family. Whoever is in charge in Downing Street, it's the most vulnerable who continue to pay the heaviest price. Without firm solutions from the political class, it seems the upcoming period might hold still more pain for those who can ill afford it. Amina Taylor, London.
UN has commemorated the third martyrdom anniversary of General Qasem Soleimani. People from different walks of life descended on the Imam Khomeini Mosalla in central Tehran to pay tribute to General Qasem Soleimani. The slain commander was a man who was widely revered as a national hero for all his efforts in the fight against terrorism and global arrogance. Addressing a ceremony, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said the message of attending the commemoration of Qasem Soleimani to all free men and women is that they should stand up and resist arrogance and block the way of oppressors and arrogant people.
Without a doubt, the reward of a national hero and a hero of the Islamic community is to protect all divine values. Commemorating General Qasem Soleimani is a global face of fighting arrogance and tyranny, glorifying all good things, and declaring hatred and aversion to oppression, arrogance, and domination.
The United States assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, along with deputy commander of Iraq's anti-terror popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandas, in a drone strike near the Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. General Soleimani is well known for dislodging Daesh terrorists in Iraq back in 2017. He also spearheaded major operations in Syria that resulted in liberating key areas from the terror group.
I have come here to honor General Qasem Soleimani. Although the enemy assassinated him, we are here to show the world that every one of us is Qasem Soleimani. His legacy of resistance will remain for good, and we will continue his path.
General Qasem Soleimani was an international personality and made great achievements in the region. Therefore, not only the Iranian people, but also the people of Iraq, Lebanon, and other countries in the region honor him. He was truly a role model for those who want to fight terrorism and resist arrogant powers.
Iranians believe although the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani put an end to his life, his legacy will continue forever, and he will remain as a role model for all resistance and anti-terror movements.
General Qasem Soleimani's personality was outstanding, not only in terms of decimating Daesh in Iraq and Syria, but also in sending out positive vibes and courage to everyone. It was actually a symbol of international resistance who redefined the rules of leadership. Salman Kujrib, Tehran.
On the third anniversary of the assassination of Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandas, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah stressed that the blood of the martyrs has given the resistance front additional strength.
As a result of this assassination, Iran took even more determined stances, and they did not fear any U.S. threats. We heard high-level stances from the Supreme Leader and the Iranian leaders. We saw a funeral unprecedented in human history where millions participated, a rebirth of the revolution in Iran, courage in shelling the Ain al-Assad base, and readiness to go to war.
Hezbollah's leader also said that after the assassination, the deal of the century ran into problems and resistance factions in Palestine gained popularity. He said resistance forces in the entire region have been steadily progressing over the past couple of years. Lebanese and Palestinian factions in Lebanon commemorated the anniversary of the assassination of the two prominent leaders in several events, which will continue throughout the week. The representative of Hezbollah's Christian ally said that the blood of martyrs is what makes the endeavor of the resistance sacred.
Martyr Qasem Soleimani did not represent one specific group or sect or religion. He represents all the oppressed in the world, and he supports the primary cause for the entire nation, which is the cause of Palestine.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas noted that it was the direct support and training of General Soleimani that helped the resistance alliance in the entire region reach a state in which it can impose its conditions on the U.S. and Israel and deter their threats.
The Resistance Alliance and its project does not confront the Zionist entity only. It also targets the colonial scheme of the U.S., which supports the Zionist project. Therefore, when the leader Qasem Soleimani helped strengthen the resistance in the region, he was targeted by the U.S., since he was confronting its massive project. This has transformed the resistance into an extended front facing the bigger project, which targets the region.
General Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, and his Iraqi companion Abu Mahdi al-Muhandas, the deputy leader of Iraq's popular mobilization units, were martyred along with several other people in a U.S. drone strike on January 3, 2020.
3 years have passed since the martyrdom of Haj Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandas, yet for many it is as if it occurred today. For the leaders of the resistance, their martyrdom together seems to have given leverage to a growing regional alliance. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Like other parts of the Muslim world,
people in Pakistan also observed the third anniversary of assassination of General Qasem Soleimani. Special conferences and seminars were held in Pakistan's capital Islamabad to highlight the role of top Iranian commander in fighting terrorism and defending Islam. The participants, including religious scholars, politicians, poets, and rights activists, termed Soleimani a hero of Islam. They said this great martyr gave dignity and honor to Muslims around the world.
Shahid Haj Qasem Soleimani.
By assassinating a great and veteran commander like Soleimani, who fought against terrorism and extremism, the U.S. push made the region vulnerable to conspiracies. Now the region is facing the negative consequences of lacking a capable and committed commander like Soleimani.
The assassination of General Qasem Soleimani by the U.S. was an operation against Islam. Because General Soleimani played a key role in defeating the Daesh Takfiri terrorist groups in West Asia and fought against international criminals.
While expressing sympathy with the Iranian nation, the participants in the ceremonies said General Soleimani set a great example of bravery and courage, which will be remembered by future generations.
General Qasem Soleimani to
the life of Soleimani gives us a lesson that we need unity and solidarity to protect ourselves against conspiracies hatched by the enemies, and that we must stand by the oppressed.
This year, the Iranian embassy in Islamabad and its consulates throughout Pakistan, particularly in Karachi, Quetta, and Lahore, organized various events to pay tribute to the late Iranian commander.
The participation of people from different walks of life in ceremonies to mark the third anniversary of General Soleimani's assassination indicates that he holds a high status in people's hearts and his sacrifice will be remembered in years to come. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely, thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
All the warning signs were there. Israel's new far-right minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, has stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds, a move that has drawn strong condemnation on an international scale. The United Arab Emirates and China have called for a UN Security Council meeting, while several countries, including Iran, Germany, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, well, they have already joined the Palestinians in denouncing the intrusion by Itamar Ben-Gvir and its storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. What is a big deal? That is what we'll be covering in this edition of The Spotlight. Our guest joining us is Elijah Magnier, who's a journalist and political analyst who joins us from Brussels to discuss this with us.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Elijah Magnier, welcome. Taking a look at the reaction that has come through on this far-right minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, tell us what you think, the volume of denouncements that have come and the criticism both from within and from the outside is somewhat a lot compared to other incidents that have happened in the occupied territories, which should also deserve the same kind of attention. How do you see this?
Thank you for having me. I think this is a continuous provocation from the Israeli sides that will never learn from history. In the year 2000, Ariel Sharon stormed the Al-Aqsa and created the Second Intifada. In 2009, again, the Internal Security Minister Yitzhak Aharonovich and Avigdor Lieberman stormed the Al-Aqsa and went into the Holy Mosque. And then now again, we see Ben-Gvir. But last year, there were around 48,000 Israeli settlers who violated the Al-Aqsa area. And this is a continuous provocation of the Israelis who are continuously insisting on occupying further territory from the Palestinians. And they have the right to do so because there are no accountability, because the Arabs are normalizing with the Israelis, because Turkey has returned the ties with Israel and re-accepted the Israeli minister. We see the ambassador. We see the Emiratis doing the same. They are flirting between Saudi Arabia and Israel. All these condemnations are really a bit folkloric. At the end of the day, if the Arabs regain relationship with Israel, Israel is going to continue violating the right of the Palestinians, continue refusing to give the Palestinians back their land, continue refusing to give a state to Palestine, and perhaps that will help the Palestinians to unite against the Israelis once for all.
Let me bring Joe Katronin, who's joining us, U.S. coordinator at the Samidun Palestine, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network from New York. Joe Katron, welcome. Taking a look at the reaction in particular, which is quite swift. I don't know if you agree with that or not. And let's focus on one that the United Arab Emirates and China have given, which is calling for a UN Security Council meeting. Now, there are a couple things here that are very interesting. First of all, this call for a UN Security Council meeting, do you think that it's going to happen? Will the UN convene on this? There are reports that they are, but what's your take on it?
I haven't had a chance to look at the process, what's involved in convening such a meeting. I can guess who the opposition is in this case, led by the United States. But given the massive outcry over this provocation, I do think, that being said, that it's very likely. It's clear that much of the world is responding strongly to this and is not willing to give it a pass, as they so often do when it comes, as you say, to other sorts of Israeli crimes against Palestinians elsewhere in the occupied territories.
When we take a look, Elijah Magner, at the United Arab Emirates' response to this, it's quite telling in the fact that, first of all, it's one of the countries, Persian Gulf Island countries, that has normalized ties with Israel. We know that Bahrain is also on that list. And we know that based on the most recent UNGA resolution, it was also one that actually voted for Israel to be referred to the ICJ, the most recent resolution. Do you think this is going to affect that relationship? Elijah Magner, go ahead.
Of course it won't affect the relationship between the Emiratis and the Israelis. Neither the Bahraini and the Israelis or Turkey and Israel or China and Israel. At the end of the day, the United Nations is controlled by the Western country, and even with condemnation, there are over 178 UN resolutions against the Israeli aggression, against the Israeli human crime, and crime against humanity, and all these have been disregarded by Israel and by the international community. So if the Emiratis is condemning or asking for a meeting for the Security Council, what is going to come out of this meeting? Everybody is aware, country leaders are aware, journalists, analysts, and observers understand very well that it's not going to lead to anything and is not going to stop the Israeli violation. And we will see more from Ben-Gvir in the next month, because he's going to be with us in the new government of the far right, and he's going to push further the Palestinian into a corner. He will mistreat them. He will establish more relationship with the Arabs. Benjamin Netanyahu already informed us that there are surprises with Saudi Arabia. All these countries who are issuing the condemnations are really bubbles, but empty bubbles. It's kind of popcorn with a lot of big size but empty inside. At the end of the day, nobody is supporting the Palestinian cause but Iran and the axis of the resistance, Syria and Iraq and Yemen. And we don't see any of the Gulf countries who are shamelessly established relationship with Israel, disregarding the right of the Palestinians, are going to come out with anything that will hurt Israel for its decision of violating the Haram Sharif.
Shokatron, do you agree?
I broadly agree, yes. I do think that the imperialist countries will move heaven and earth to defend Israel, even in the face of these unprecedented provocations, unprecedented in their own way. Certainly we've seen equally grotesque Zionist crimes, starting with the ethnic cleansing, the Nakba of 1948. But this new approach of open aggression, not only against Palestinians, but against world opinion, is something new. And those who seek to defend Israel in the face of this behavior will have their work cut out for them. But I do think that they are ultimately likely to succeed in the short term, at least in terms of defending it in the UN and similar venues like that, that would be in a position to impose meaningful sanctions in response.
Okay, well, I'm going to try to see if I can get some hope into this, and maybe something will happen. So, Elijah Magnier, let me start with the U.S. reaction here. That was quite interesting. I don't know what you think, where U.S. said in a warning that it could provoke violence, and the U.S. actually did say, or recall a 2000 visit by, as you mentioned, the then opposition leader Ariel Sharon, which became one of the main triggers for the second Palestinian Intifada, which lasted until the year 2005. That was a U.S. reaction. What do you think of it?
I think there are very bad relationship between the current U.S. administration and Benjamin Netanyahu, and that is not unknown. However, the relation, the strategic relationship between the Israelis and the Americans will not change the position of the Americans toward Israel. Even if the Americans express their concern about the arrival of Ben-Gvir and the other far-right members of the Israeli government, we have to know that in Israel, there are the far-right and the far-far-right that are leading the country. How it means that we don't have moderate. There are no moderate in Israel. There are only far-right people who try to race among each other who's going to kill more Palestinians, or who's saying that he has killed in the past more Palestinians or has no problem in killing more Palestinians. Well, the only thing that we cannot blame the Americans here or the Israelis or the Arabs who normalize with Israel, we have really to look at the Palestinian unity. If the Palestinians are not going to be united, then the Israelis and the Americans and the Arab will always make fun of them, will disregard their rights, will close an eye of whatever the Israelis are doing, and Benjamin Netanyahu will certainly start building more settlements and will not look at what the United Nations or other international laws are saying or say about this issue, because Israel has always violated international laws.
Taking a look at now the Palestinian reactions, Joe Catron, I'm going to go with what Hamas has said, where it has said in terms of the whole, desecration, that this move is crossing its red line. And it's holding talks right now to see what will be the next move. And now you have Ben-Gvir, who has said that there won't be racist discrimination. I'm paraphrasing. Jews will visit the Temple Mount, as he calls it. We made it clear to Hamas, we don't give in, we don't surrender, we don't blink. Do you think that the way that Ben-Gvir is approaching this, and we're only looking at, what, 6 days since the Knesset convened, and of course we are aware of the history of Ben-Gvir. I mean, maybe everyone isn't, but pretty much whoever follows Israeli politics is aware of Ben-Gvir and who he is. So are we being set up here? Because our guest Elijah Magner makes a good point. No matter what UN resolutions have been passed, the U.S. has been there. The U.S. is not going to break its, as it has said, unwavering support of Israel. So what are we looking at here when it comes to the way Ben-Gvir has moved ahead, especially with this move with Al-Aqsa Mosque, and of course the way the Palestinians are reacting?
Ben-Gvir has historically been an extreme marginal figure, even by the standards of the Zionist movement and the Zionist regime in Tel Aviv. And his sorts have typically been arrayed against more pragmatic Zionists who are satisfied with the status quo, which has largely worked out to their benefit. And this is certainly the arrangements that are favored by the American ruling class and government, and ruling classes and governments elsewhere in the imperialist countries. They're happy with things as they've been going, and they see no reason to change them. Ben-Gvir, as an extreme ideologue, is now upsetting this in a way that we haven't exactly seen in some time. And it's a reflection of the political crisis of Zionism that he's in a position to do so. A few years ago, it would have been unthinkable for such a frankly clownish figure to occupy such a key position in an Israeli government. Today, that's the only way a viable Israeli government can be assembled, by incorporating these kinds of figures. So as a result, the pragmatic Zionists and the imperialists are going to find it very difficult to proceed as they largely have by maintaining the status quo with incremental gains here and there. Ben-Gvir and those like him are determined to shake things up, to advance the speed of Zionist gains in occupied Palestine. And what the Palestinian response will be, of course, remains to be seen, and will have a great deal to do with how the rest of the world responds. In May 2021, we saw this kind of aggression against Al-Aqsa Mosque result in an unprecedented level of Palestinian unity in the popular uprising of that year, which was reflected in broad solidarity across the world. What's happening now, what's going to happen next, I really can't say, but we'll see.
Well, maybe his portfolio may indicate as to what's going to be happening this year. Elijah Magner, Ben-Gvir has under his watch and responsibility Israeli forces, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, taking a look at settlements, taking a look at the overall, security situation. He has said, as an example, when it comes to Palestinians, once I become minister, I would promote a law that imposes the death penalty against all Palestinian terrorists and would execute the ones who commit acts of terror. Israeli prisons, under those laws, the Knesset member said that there would be no use for the Israeli prisons. For soldiers, I would provide immunity for all Israeli soldiers. Aren't we being set up for what's to come?
I think Ben-Gvir considers every Palestinian good to be killed, and he would wish to see everybody piled up in Gaza, and even the West Bank is without Palestinian. Even for him, the 1948 Palestinians who are living in different Israeli and Palestinian occupied cities, for him, they should be stripped from the nationality if they support the Palestinian and they are not loyal to Israel. For him, he doesn't Palestinian on the Palestinian occupied territory. He just wants Israelis to be there. And he is pulling a group from the army and from the border troops to bring them in the country to kill more Palestinians, to harm more Palestinians, to close more on the Palestinian movement and restrict their daily movement. He wants really to suffocate the Palestinian. This is why he insisted in taking the international, the internal security, because he wants to use the most horrible measures against the Palestinians to push them out of their territory and to push more Palestinian exodus from their own country. That is the objective of Ben-Gvir, and this is why the Americans, just to fake their concern about democracy, because they are very much aware what Itamar Ben-Gvir is capable of, told the world that they are concerned about what Ben-Gvir is going to do. But are they going to take measure against the Israeli government? Of course not. Are they going to refuse to deal with Ben-Gvir? Certainly not. They're going to deal with the Israelis, business as usual, and from time to time we will hear some Americans just expressing some condemnation just to make sure that they still carry the flag of democracy, like to blur the eye of the world. Ben-Gvir is today, has been selected by Benjamin Netanyahu just to make sure that the Palestinian will be totally oppressed and suffocated, and it's up to the Palestinian to react to that.
Okay. It's very hard, isn't it, Jokatron, when I hear Larry Magnier talk there, it's very hard to imagine how much worse it can get for Palestinians. But given the context that Elijah Magnier just put for us and the information that I gave, that is a possibility. But how can the reaction in the past then suffice, the American reaction or the Palestinian reaction for that matter, or the world reaction? Because if those things happen, there needs to be, we need to enter another phase to stand up to the occupying regime. What could that be?
Well, I don't presume to tell Palestinians under occupation how they should proceed. Of course, in May 2021, as I mentioned, the unprecedented unity of the uprising, and particularly the armed resistance from Gaza, quickly brought Israel to heel, forcing an end to its incursions at that time into Al-Aqsa. What's going to happen now is, I can't immediately say. I don't think anything is definite. Much depends on what the next steps are and how much Ben-Gvir and other figures like him are allowed to provoke. As for the rest of us, I think our tasks are clear, certainly within imperialist countries like the United States. As always, we need to figure out how to end our government's support for the Israeli occupation regime. Our task remains the same, even if the clownishness of a figure like Ben-Gvir in some ways may make it easier. Certainly, Joe Biden is going to find the behavior of the new Israeli government less hard to defend, if only because they don't make any effort at all to hide their aims. Elijah mentioned Ben-Gvir's goal as being the displacement of Palestinians. I fully agree, but I would add to that that that's the goal of Zionism as a whole and of all Zionists. Their disagreements are about strategies and tactics, how they're going to drive Palestinians out of their land and steal it for themselves. And the antics of someone like Ben-Gvir will make it increasingly difficult, I might go so far as to say impossible, for Israel's defenders to pretend something else is going on.
Thank you very much. We're going to have to end it there. Joe Catron, U.S. Coordinator, Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network. Elijah Magnier, thank you so much. Journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitale and the team. It's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In the U.S., Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger says the former President Donald Trump should be charged with conspiracy over the Capitol insurrection. We'll take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British news outlet The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger said in an interview on Sunday that he believes the Department of Justice will do the right thing and bring criminal charges against Donald Trump for his role in the attack on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021. "I think he will be charged, and I frankly think he should be charged," Adam Kinzinger told CNN's State of the Union political talk show on Sunday morning, 1st of January. Representative Adam Kinzinger, a Republican from Illinois, thinks the Department of Justice will charge Donald Trump. "I think the Justice Department will do the right thing. I think he will be charged. I frankly think he should be." Last month, the House Select Committee investigating the attack on which Kinzinger sits voted to refer the former president to the Justice Department on charges of obstruction of an official proceeding of Congress, conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to make a false statement, and incite, assist, or aid or comfort an insurrection. The recommendations relate to the former U.S. president's role in encouraging the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C., as thousands of his extremist supporters sought to prevent the certification by Congress of Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 presidential election. "If he is not guilty of a crime, then I frankly fear for the future of this country, because now every future president can say, 'Hey, here's the bar.' And the bar is, do everything you can to stay in power," Kinzinger said. Adam Kinzinger was one of two Republicans on the Democratic-led January 6 Select Committee, which wrapped up its investigation before the new Congress begins on Tuesday, 3rd of January, when Republicans will assume the majority in the House following last November's midterm elections. Kinzinger led one of the committee's sessions last June that focused on pressure allegedly placed on the Justice Department by Trump or his allies, as he strove to persuade them to overturn his 2020 defeat by falsely claiming the election was blighted by widespread voter fraud. He has represented Illinois in the House of Representatives since 2011 and was speaking following the last session held by the committee and on the eve of his departure from Congress. Adam Kinzinger also slammed Republican leaders for maintaining Donald Trump's influence on the U.S. Capitol landscape by playing down the significance of the Capitol attack and Trump's incitement of the riot, and often backing Trump's lies about elections being rigged. He blamed the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy in particular, who is currently battling to become the new Speaker of the House, as the reason the former President Donald Trump remains such a force in U.S. politics. "He is the reason Donald Trump is still a factor," Adam Kinzinger said. "He," referring to Kevin McCarthy, "is the reason that some of the crazy elements of the House still exist." Kevin McCarthy, he said, has visited Trump at his Mar-a-Lago, Florida residence shortly after the January 6 insurrection. That show of mutual support at a pivotal moment resurrected Trump's relevance in politics, strengthening the right. In McCarthy making the trip, he said, Republicans went from not knowing what to do about Trump to begrudgingly defending him. "Donald Trump should consider Kevin McCarthy his best friend, because Donald Trump is alive today politically because of Kevin McCarthy," Adam Kinzinger said. He noted that the then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and other Senate Republicans failed to convict Trump during his historic second impeachment for inciting the insurrection. "The Republican Party is not the future of this country unless It corrects itself, he said. If you think of a successful America in 20 years' time, that's not going to be an America based on what Marjorie Taylor Greene wants, or some of these radicals want, he added. As the 2024 presidential election gradually takes shape, Adam Kinzinger said, he was fearful for American democracy, given that maybe a third of the country believes the last election was stolen from Donald Trump. The Republican congressman said it was not his intention to run for the Republican presidential nomination, but he conceded that it would be fun to run against Trump, who, in November, declared his candidacy for the 2024 Republican nomination. The website Axios.com has also covered this story and tells us more. Outgoing Representative Adam Kinzinger, Republican of Illinois, said in an interview on CNN's State of the Union on Sunday that he fears for the future of this country if former President Donald Trump isn't charged with a crime over the deadly 6th of January 2021 insurrection. If this is not a crime, I don't know what it is, Kinzinger, one of two Republican members of the House January 6th committee, told CNN. If a president can incite an insurrection and not be held accountable, then really there is no limit to what a president can do or can't do. Kinzinger, who was also one of the 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump for incitement of the insurrection in January of 2021, announced later that year that he would not seek re-election in October of 2021. I think the Justice Department will do the right thing. I think he will be charged, and I frankly think he should be charged, Kinzinger told CNN. If he's not guilty of a crime, then I frankly fear for the future of this country. I feel honored to be at this moment in history and to have done the right thing, he added. In an unprecedented move, the January 6th panel voted unanimously in December to refer Donald Trump to the Department of Justice on at least four criminal charges for his efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election results. The House committee referred Donald Trump, who has announced a 2024 White House bid on charges of obstruction of an official congressional proceeding, conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to make a false statement, and incite, assist, or aid and comfort an insurrection. The referrals do not require the Department of Justice to take any additional steps. However, the referrals could help with the Department of Justice's own investigation into Donald Trump. Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed Special Counsel Jack Smith to oversee the federal criminal investigations into Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election and handling of classified documents that will be tasked with prosecuting federal crimes that arise from the investigations. The January 6th House panel has released dozens of transcripts along with its long-awaited final report, making public witness testimony gathered from its 18-month investigation into the Capitol riot. The House committee is set to resolve on Tuesday, 3rd of January 2023, at the start of the new Congress, which will see Republicans narrowly take control of the House of Representatives.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.